All right. Better stop that music. Because some of you all are dancing right now in your cars. I don't want you to get out and do, well, it's not the Kiki challenge. You do the, I guess you'll be doing the Gap Band challenge. Out on Broad Street. Dancing, embarrassing yourselves. So let's just stop it right now. What's up, Denise?
Not much. How about you?
Oh, it's all good. Just coming to you live this morning from the bunker location, but everything is well.
Is Dick Cheney there with you, or are you by yourself?
No, he's probably out trying to shoot somebody in the face.
I know. That has always fascinated me. I mean, that's one of those people that, you know, I will never go hunting with this dude because he tends to shoot his friends in the face. And, you know, to tell you just how gangster Dick Cheney is, or, and there's a certain level of gangster you have to be for this. The guy he shot in the face apologized to him. And I am still trying to figure out in what universe somebody can shoot you in the face. And because it ends up being this news story and you feel like you inconvenienced him somehow, which I'm like, how did you inconvenience him by inconveniently getting his buckshot in your face?
Pretty much.
Yes, he apologized to dude. You know, he apologized. I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, that my getting shot in the face by you caused you so much problems.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you. Hey, Dick, what did you bag today? Ah, just got a judge. Oh, how many points was it? You know, 20 point, 30 point? How big was that antler? Mm-hmm. He just had a black robe. Speaking of justice being shot and apologizing. Today, the big story coming out of Philadelphia, and I'm sure this will make national news as well as it should, is the indictment of former police officer Ryan Pownau in the June 8th, 2017 shooting death of a motorist, David Jones. So you've heard us, if you've listened to the show at any time, for any length of time, you have heard us repeatedly talk about this case as being one that really should have led to an indictment right away. But for whatever reason, it did not. You know, I have to kind of take you back over the timeline. I think at that time, Seth Williams was still technically the DA. He had not been convicted yet. Is that right, Denise?
I don't even think he had gone to trial yet. I mean, he had been indicted, but he hadn't gone to trial yet.
Right. And so Seth obviously did not touch it. Kelly Hodges was appointed interim district attorney after Seth Williams was convicted and sent to prison and cited a conflict of interest that she never disclosed the reason.
Which actually we found out yesterday what the conflict was.
Really? What was it?
Yes. Apparently she had a personal relationship with someone in the Pownau family. Activists are saying that the personal relationship was that Pownau's sister worked in the DA's office or something to that effect. I'm not going to, you know, put that out there, you know, as fact because I haven't been able to confirm it yet. But, you know, at the very least, Larry Krasner expanded on what the conflict was when he talked to reporters yesterday. Now, because I got the press release for that like minutes after I got off the air here and yesterday. And when I went to the press conference, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, if anyone had told me, you know, 10 years ago that I would be sitting in a press conference with the DA charging a police officer with murder, I'd have looked at them like they were crazy, because the last time that a police officer was charged with murder in the city of Philadelphia, it was Officer Christopher DePasquale in the case of Donta Dawson. And the only reason that he got charged was because Michael Cord, friend of the show and activist, lawyer, and self-described angriest black man in America, filed a civilian criminal complaint and kind of forced Lynn Abraham's hand. Ultimately, that case never went to trial. It went before two judges, and both judges threw it out. But that was the last time that a police officer was charged with the murder of a citizen here in Philadelphia. And while, you know, these charges have been leveled and they're, you know, they went for criminal homicide, you know, possessing an instrument of crime, recklessly endangering another person, they went for the whole nine. You have to remember that the Fraternal Order of Police is going to go out and get that, like, Pownell has a legal team, or at least that's what John McNesby called Fortunato Perry Jr. and the lawyers who will be representing Pownell yesterday during their press conference. You know, it's the indictment happened, but for the family of David Jones, who was looking for justice and is hoping that they will, you know, get their day in court, September 19th is going to be where the rubber meets the road, because that's when Pownell has his preliminary hearing, and that will determine what charges actually stick, if any, and whether or not this case actually goes to trial.
Well, let me ask this. So is Pownell in jail now waiting for that hearing?
He is in jail under remand, because in Pennsylvania, thanks to a constitutional amendment that Lynn Abraham and company put forth when she was district attorney, if you are indicted on a top count of murder, you are denied bail automatically. You are automatically remanded. So Officer Pownell, well, former Officer Pownell, is in jail. And my guess is, because of who he was, who he is, what he was, what he's accused of, and the fact that there were like 39 people who he arrested that filed complaints against him, and, you know, most of the folks in jail know somebody who's been harassed by a cop, they're probably, he's probably in solitary confinement or something, like some sort of special administrative dispensation, and he's probably being watched 24 hours a day to make sure that he gets to his preliminary hearing.
Wow. Interesting. So we'll be breaking that down today. We're going to have Asa Khalif, Coalition of Black Lives, on at 7:20. Certainly he will be, he has a great deal of interest in this. We'll also speak at 7:40 to the man of the hour, the person who brought the charge, the district attorney of Philadelphia, actually 7:45. Mm-hmm. District Attorney Larry Krasner will be calling in this morning to let you, the listeners of Mark and Denise in the Mornings, know what led him to this charge and, you know, kind of get a sense from him. I mean, listen, this is not an easy charge to bring if you're a district attorney, especially in a city like Philadelphia.
Oh, no.
There's often no light between, you know, uniformed law enforcement and the DA's office, which is supposed to be for both, you know, for everyone. But historically, it has not been that way. So this is a radical departure from what we are accustomed to. And so want to hear his take. I'm sure he did not take this lightly. You know, you do this as an elected official, you're kind of putting your whole elected career on the line doing it. So we'll talk to him. And then finally, at 8 o'clock, we'll speak to Elder Melanie DeBose of Evangel Chapel in the city of Philadelphia and one of the members of Power. She's a board member and also one of my co-chairs of the Live Free campaign, which is interested in criminal justice reform and public safety. We'll get her thoughts on this as well. She's been an outspoken critic of the lack of doing this so often, so I want to get her take. And then we'll take your phone calls if you're interested in getting in today. Are you shocked? Are you surprised that the district attorney actually brought charges against a police officer, and not just a light charge, but murder in the first degree? Mm-hmm. Wow. And what do you think? Do you think it's going to stick? Do you think he's going to downgrade it? Or a judge is going to downgrade it when you get to the hearing. You know, so we'll get into all of that today. But again, if you want to get in, the number is 888-329-3306, 888-329-3306. You can also join the conversation with others on Facebook Live, like Tamiko and Shirley, like Bruce and Regina, like Craig and Sheila and John. John Sharon, I know you got some thoughts about this. You were at a number of those marches and protests in support of David Jones, like LaTanja and Franny, and of course, Sandra Fields. Listen, holding it down on social media, by the way, is Leslie Maria Tyler, our executive producer for the show. And on the board today, it's not Dan. Don't get worried. Don't get, you know, tricked and lulled into thinking that it's Thursday. It's not. It's Wednesday. September the 5th. But Dan had an obligation this morning. So Mike is holding it down. He's in a day early today. And so again, good conversation lined up for you today. If you missed our show yesterday and you also missed the Aretha Franklin funeral, I encourage you to go listen to the podcast, download it. We had a wide array of guests who hit it from every particular perspective. You can get it on iTunes or at WWDBAM.com. You can pull the podcast down. Hey, Denise, the only thing we didn't cover about the funeral yesterday, and it hit me when I went home, we didn't talk about Cicely Tyson's hat.
And we should. And we should, because that was a magnificent piece of millinery. It was. No. I mean, first of all, when she walked in, I was like, wow, who is under that hat? That is a bad hat. And then, you know, when she picked up her head, and I was like, well, of course Cicely Tyson is wearing that hat. I can't think of anyone else off the top of my head who has the gravitas to pull that hat off.
Yeah. Hey, and, man, Cicely, she rocked it. In fact, Leslie wants that hat. She was. I'm glad we weren't at the funeral, because it may have been an embarrassing moment watching her take that hat and take off running out the church. She and a lot of other first ladies around the country were thinking it. I'm telling you, they were like, I got to have that hat for church.
And another thing I noticed was there were a lot of pillbox hats. And I guess the pillbox hat is making a comeback. And that's good, because, you know, I've always liked them, you know, with the little veil in front and everything. It's a hat, but it's not a hat. It's kind of like real close to a fascinator. And, you know, which, again, is a type of hat, but it's not, you know, a big head covering hat. It's like, it's hat light.
Well, that was so just so you know, in my house, as the funeral was unfolding, that was the other conversation, just kind of listening to Leslie, the hat critic, just kind of. So Leslie has a lot of hats.
Oh, yeah. Leslie has the hat collection of life.
I won't say that there's an entire room that has hats in it, but it's close. It's very close. I mean, suffice it to say, ladies, if you're out there and you're in a hat emergency, you can call my wife and she will hook you up and take care of you. And so she was, I mean, Leslie looks great in hats, in church hats. I mean, seriously. And so she was like a whole different conversation of her just listening to her like, oh, I don't like that fascinator. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. That's too much. Those feathers. No, it doesn't go right with her. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, just the sidebar commentaries. I'm just like listening. It was hilarious. So yes. The fashion was on full display. We wanted to speak to Elizabeth Wellington, Philadelphia.com's fashion editor, a fashion writer. Elizabeth has been on our show before. She had a conflict yesterday, but just to get her whole take on, you know, on this. Oh, thank you, Tamiko. Do you know I never knew that's how you spelled fascinators? Thank you. Would have never guessed it. It took me a while to even learn what a fascinator was, by the way.
And see, the thing is, I have hats, but I can't really wear them because I haven't figured out how to wear a hat and an afro simultaneously. I know there is probably a way, but I have not figured it out.
I want to see you like doing some kind of press event. You got your hand up for the question. The camera's pans to Denise with that Cicely Tyson hat on. Yes.
And I would do that. I would. I would wear that hat to a news conference. I really would. Granted, I would walk in and folks would look at me and ask me, okay, well, where are you going after this?
Right. Well, speaking of funerals, one funny thing out of the John McCain funeral, we didn't get a chance to talk much about his funeral, but are the images of George W. Bush and Michelle Obama sharing snacks.
That is a relationship. Yeah, that is a friendship that seems to have fascinated everybody, because if you look at those two people on paper,
Right.
You would not expect them to get along the way they apparently do. And, you know, it, for all of the mess that George W. Bush left her husband, and he left some mess, you know, it appears that since neither Barack Obama nor George W. Bush is president anymore, since they're no longer, you know, in the Oval Office, you know, they seem to be able to interact with each other, at, you know, as human beings. And I guess that's good, you know, that folks can interact with each other as human beings, you know, despite the fact that you actually have people look at this and they're like, oh, why is he, you know, talking to him? And, you know, and I'm like, well, because at the very end, we are all human beings.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, that's important that we're all human beings.
Yep. So it's just, you know, listen, in an era where there's so much polarization and, you know, especially when it comes to politics and people have taken sides and, you know, you got the image yesterday of Brett Kavanaugh not even shaking the hand of the father of a Parkland shooter. I mean, so in an era of where it's so contentious, to be able to see that, again, it just gives you hope. You know, I mean, yeah. Listen, we have some serious differences for sure, but we shouldn't lose our civility and our humanity. And if you're in church and you got snacks and you're a Democrat and a Republican is sitting next to you and they're hungry because they've been in the funeral for 8 hours, share a snack and vice versa.
Well, first of all, John McCain's funeral wasn't going to be an 8 hour affair. That was a military funeral. Having experienced military funerals, they are about as precise as you will ever see. They had allotted 2 hours for McCain's funeral. They were done in an hour and a half.
Yeah. Military doesn't play.
Mm-mm.
So, right. So listen, later today, Denise, once we get through our first three interviews here, we will spend a little bit of time permitting to have a conversation about Bob Woodard's new book on Donald Trump, and maybe talk a little bit about the hearings yesterday on Brett Kavanaugh, which got, I mean, you know, talking about the chairman was pretty testy. Sounded like he needed a snack. He needed a Snickers,
well,
as they said yesterday.
Grassley's been testy practically from birth, I think.
He looks like
he was born testy.
Yeah, he was not having it yesterday. They were getting on his last nerve. And then we'll talk about John Bobbitt Jr. in Philadelphia, the homeless man who a couple raised $400,000 for. We understand now that his lawyer says that money is all gone. The family said a couple of weeks ago there was about $200,000 left in it. His lawyer saying, nope, there's nothing. And so back to scratch, I foresee a new GoFundMe campaign for John Bobbitt Jr., but that's that. And so we'll talk about that. But right now, let's talk about the news of the day, which is Ryan Paunow being arrested and charged with murder in the first degree, possession of an instrument of crime, and reckless endangerment. He was charged for doing all these things while in uniform and on duty in the killing death of David Jones on June 8th, 2017. There are a number of people who have been following this case, activists, journalists, and others. Friday, we'll talk to a couple other folk, Ike Raw and Chris Norris, most notably. But today, I want to speak to Asa Khalif, Coalition of Black Lives, one of the first people to bring this story to the attention of the community. And Asa Khalif, friend of the show, good morning. Welcome back to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning.
You know, I would actually pay money to see Denise wear that Cicely Tyson hat. I mean, I'm talking top dollar money.
Well, hey, so, you know, Leslie just put on social media that Denise, that there's, so Leslie has a few people that she goes to get hats from. Denise, she's saying that she has a Helen, a quote unquote Helen hat that will look great on you.
Okay, well.
Give her a call.
Yeah, okay, I will do that.
Yeah. Give me a closet back. Hey, Asa, by the way, before we get into this case, hey, thank you as well for being one of those persons who went to GoFundMe and supported and propped up the show. Certainly appreciate it. And for those who are listening, go and do likewise. GoFundMe.com and look for Mark and Denise in the mornings. Appreciate you.
No, no problem at all. Your voice and Denise's voice, the show is very important, as you can see. So I'm very happy to do it and hopefully contribute some more also. We're telling everybody, sharing the GoFundMe page, support Mark and Denise and more.
Hey, thank you, man. Thank you. Listen, so Asa, you were actually arrested trying to get into Josh Shapiro's office when the case was taken out of Philadelphia and sent to him when Kelly Hodges, interim DA, cited a conflict of interest. That was extremely controversial, as you all were demanding answers in this case. So kind of talk about your own, feelings yesterday, watching Powell now get arrested and charged.
Well, it was a mixed emotion because when you think of Ryan Pinal's arrest coming out of the 15th District, you have to think about all the other victims who have been murdered out of that district, including my cousin, Brandon Tate Brown, including Jeffrey Dennis, recently who was shot by a 15th District police officer. So it was mixed emotion. I did speak with the family and spoke with David Jones's father, who I've been in contact with, Tommy. And, the family is very relieved that this hurdle, they're over this hurdle, but they clearly understand, as well as all of us, who have been a part of this, we understand that the battle is just beginning. We are in for a huge battle. Like you pointed out, 20 years since a police officer, was charged, and that was, Brother Michael Court brought that case. The Dante Dawson case, but 20 years, so this was a huge milestone in Philadelphia. And I appreciate the district attorney. I've been critical, but he knows that I said I would be critical, and I would praise when praise is needed. So I want to thank Larry for that, for having a thorough investigation. It was timely, but it was thorough. and he had the courage. And we're going to have to back him as activists because, he's going to need a food taster bringing charges against this police officer. It's going to be very difficult. And especially in a culture with you're dealing with police and police culture and how they view black and brown bodies, they're going to be intimidated. Every court appearance is going to be flooded with cops. So this is a time where the activists are truly, and I made the call yesterday, going to have to truly put aside their differences, because we don't do all, everything the same. But we're fighting for the same cause. And so if you truly care and love for this family, and I've gotten to know them throughout this battle, and you truly want justice, then we're going to have to band together as a united front to stand with the family in every court hearing, every preliminary hearing, and every jury selection, whatever. We have to be there for them, and we have to stand united.
Yeah. So I know Denise is going to have some questions as well. But I want to ask you this, since you kind of brought this up about activists doing things in different ways. So, listen, I personally would not have gone to the officer's house, but I support you when you and, others went to his house to protest, last year to keep attention and pressure on. So we have different ways of how we do things and different reasons why. Do you have a sense of, because that you caught a lot of heat. I think of all the things you've done since I've known you, that was the one that seemed to have just triggered a lot of people. Do you have a sense now of being vindicated because the charges come up, because the story never died and he was ultimately fired and now charged?
Absolutely, Rev. And as I told Denise a few weeks back when we had a conversation on the air about going to the police officer's house, that was not an easy decision for any of the activists and any of the individuals who stood with us. For me personally, I knew what the consequences were. I knew the backlash that I was going to personally receive. I prayed over that. I really, truly prayed and wrestled over that, that decision. But I'm very comfortable with the decision that was made. It had to be done. We had to make send an extreme message that we can no longer allow police officers to get away with murder. We cannot have another Brandon Tate. And so shout out to all the activists and most of those people, some of those people who were a part of that demonstration, part of that action, have never been activists in their lives. Some of them were part of the, you know, Jones family or had connections with the Jones family. Others were business owners. Others were white allies who really suffered a lot. You know, there were people who were there that day who truly felt that justice must be served and that we have to stand with and keep our promise to the Jones family that we would stand with them and continue to keep David Jones's name alive. So I don't regret going to the office of home. I believe a week after that action, he was fired. Sometimes you have to be militant in that regard to force the hand of the powers that be to do the right thing. So it was controversial, but if I had a chance or a choice to do it all over again, I would not change my decision to stand with the activists and others because David Jones' family deserves that type of justice. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, I guess because I covered the district attorney's press conference yesterday. I didn't get to make it to the outer rim of Northeast Philadelphia where the FOP's new headquarters is, but I did watch the press conference with John McNesby. Were you at all surprised at his reaction? And what do you think this indictment might do for how police, you know, treat people on the street, and are activists kind of like keeping an eye out for that?
Well, nothing that John McNesby says regarding police, especially defending their conduct of violence, surprises me. This is the same individual who, you know, called activists who were exercising their First Amendment right to protest peacefully, regardless of what you felt about the language. We had every right to protest. We were not on the property of the officer, so we were exercising our First Amendment right. And for him to call us rabid animals, it's just a built-in culture in the police, you know, when it concerns black and brown bodies, even those bodies who have who are draped in police uniform. We just seen recently with the letter, you know, we all know what the, you know, who, when you refer to Riz, who you're referring to, and all the negative stereotypes. So that's the culture, that's the mindset that's been passed down since the police were formed and they were called slave patrols. So, you know, nothing that he says, you know, surprises me. It's a mentality that he loves to be in. He certainly does not have black and brown bodies best interest at heart, not even his own black and brown officers, and I know that firsthand. So, you know, McNesby was being McNesby, so there was no big surprise there.
And I guess, do you see, like I said, do you see there being a backlash? Because, because, you know, like I said, just watching the McNesby press conference, I'm like, I don't know. I wouldn't even jaywalk right now.
You know, well, Larry Krasner ran on accountability, and he's holding, you know, his end of the bargain up. Police must understand that they are not judge, jury, and executioner. There are protocols, there are laws, there are a system that's set up. It's not a perfect system, but it's a system that's set up where you have a judge, you have a jury, you have your day in court. And police officers don't have the right to take that away from your day in court. By determining that you are guilty and they're going to exercise their license to kill to murder you. And so this sends a message. Yes, there will be backlash. There are always going to be backlash and pushback when you try to break down a system. You know, you got police officers and politicians who back them. You know, they want to build this racist system up. And activists like myself, you know, and others who are in the Black Lives Matter movement and just active spirit, you know, we want to tear down that system brick by hypocritical brick. And so it starts with, maybe it will start with a banal. It has, you know, we have to send a message that black lives do matter and police are not above the law. And when you overstep that line, you will be arrested and you will be prosecuted. You will go to trial. And so we need someone who's progressive, who is not afraid, and someone who has the courage to do this. And that person is Larry Krasner in this particular case. But maybe this, again, will send a message to other district attorneys who are, you know, who will pick up the call and decide that they will not be controlled by the FOP or police or what people think or may think. You know, we have to send a message that citizens in this city, black and brown citizens in particular, are protected and they are supported. And, you know, and so it does send a message. Now, hopefully the police will get that message and change their behaviors and their mindset when it comes to policing black and brown bodies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it just... I'm just still stuck on the FOP response to this because, you know, the problem here for those who, you know, who constantly say, don't judge, I'm talking about law enforcement. You know, when I hear police officers talk to me and they say, you know, Rev, y'all are just too hard on us. You know, you don't understand. And, you know, man, we're good and blah, blah. I'm like, you know, here's the problem though. It's like, you know, let's say a particular church had a particular issue with, I don't know, children. And like you're more interested in defending the institution than you are about children. It would be hard for us to say that you're a good religious leader if you have protected people, even if you yourself never touched a child. But if you have mm-hmm. been the person who has protected the institution and the people who did it so that more children were victimized, it's kind of hard to say, you know, you're a good religious leader. You understand? And so if you're an officer, and you see this guy, Pownall, shot a man in the back in 2010. He's got all these civilian complaints against him. He is in the act of carrying, transporting victims of almost abduction to give their testimony. He stops to do this minor traffic infraction and then shoot somebody in the back who's not even a threat to him. And you defend him and you call it an outrage that he is even charged. You know, where are the police who are denouncing Pownall and denouncing the statement by the FOP? If you're a good cop, then come out and say, that doesn't speak for me. That John McNesby does not speak for me. I mean, it just gets my blood boiling. Because to hear them, the first thing they'll say, you know, Asa, is, well, you don't know, Rev, if we do that, then they won't, you know, come out and protect us on a call. Well, dude, you're a cop. Mm-hmm. You know, aren't you supposed aren't you supposed to have courage?
And if these are such bad apples and you say they're very few, then you are the majority. So you should be able to overpower them and cast them out. But, you know, again, and I explained to a lot of people, we're not just necessarily battling against the flesh. We're battling against spiritual wickedness in high places. The same spirit of racism that was in Ryan Pownall that allowed him or forced him to stop and put witnesses in jeopardy just so he could satisfy his bloodlust, in my opinion, to shoot someone, because he did this a few years before David Jones, of course, our brother Carnell Carney Williams, you know, who is still suffering physically, and I spoke with him last night. He's still suffering from the trauma and the of the bullet and that Ryan Pownall put into his back. So, you know, it just didn't end because he was found, not guilty or in the civil suit. This is long-term trauma that this man has perpetrated on black and brown bodies in this city. And it's time for a message, a direct message to be sent. No more. We'll start with you, and then we'll work our way down, and we'll work our way back up again. Because if we can get a conviction for him for killing David Jones, we can get a conviction for the two officers involved in Brandon Tate Brown. We can get a conviction for Dennis Plowden Jr. We can get a conviction for Nyza Morris, last a trans woman of color last seen by the 6th District. I mean, it goes on and on, but it has to start let it start with mine for now.
All right. Well, Asa, we're going to all be watching this together. And so this is a good day for those who've been following this case. And it's also a great reminder that elections have consequences.
Absolutely. And I also, before I go, I want to thank you guys at Power, especially you, Rev and Reverend Holston. You guys have been on the front line with this. And I know it's not easy standing with me at times, but you guys, you know, have always stood for right. And you've always stood with the David Jones family, and they are very appreciative of that as well.
Well, hey, no problem. And anytime any of the family wants to come on the air and talk, and I know it's difficult, so I've not really pushed for that. But if they want to, we'd be happy to have them on.
Okay, I'm going to arrange that. I think his father may be willing to say a few things, but we'll talk about that off the air.
Sure. All right. Well, thanks, hey, have a good day.
Yes, thank you.
You did the same. Thank you. Have a good show, guys.
All right. That's Asa Khalif, Coalition of Black Lives, who has been a part of the ongoing actions. In fact, it was so funny. I meant to ask Asa about this. I'll ask him next time, Denise, that we were talking about this yesterday in an unrelated place about you can't just get people that you want elected, but then you have to also hold them accountable. And people were kind of citing what happened with President Obama that, you know, kind of the progressive left just thought getting him in would be enough and just backed off. But let me tell you, remember at Larry Krasner's inauguration?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as it was over, right there in the lobby of the Kimmel Center, here comes Asa and a group protesting Krasner that they just helped get elected. I mean, if you see the night Krasner was elected, you know, won the primary, I think it was, Asa is literally on the stage right there with other people holding up signs like, yay, we did it. And right after he's inaugurated, he's in the hallway protesting them, saying, now indict Officer Powell now.
Well, you know, hey, Asa is nothing if not willing to remind you that you made a promise and that you need to stick to it. And the thing is, you have a lot of people, because I heard a little bit of this during the FOP press conference. You know, while you know, finding justice for victims of police abuse was part of Larry Krasner's platform, grand juries tend not to indict people or recommend indictments of people because the indictment is based on the recommendations of the grand jury. They tend not to do that with political considerations in mind. They do it because they look at a preponderance of the evidence and they say, well, at the very least, this should go to trial. Someone should look at this. And, you know, this grand jury was probably at it for a while because grand juries take a lot of time to make the decisions they make. And they have access to evidence that, you know, prosecutors won't get their hands on until the trial is set. And the thing is, while this indictment is important, especially in a city like Philadelphia, I'm probably going to be covering the trial if it happens. But the question, the key phrase in the sentence is, if it happens. Because, like I said, 20 years ago, Michael Kord filed a civilian complaint. Lynn Abraham had to take it to court. And two judges threw it out.
But there's a big difference here. Because Lynn Abrams was not in favor of bringing any charges against that officer to begin with, mm-hmm. and didn't put anything behind it. I think the difference here is that you actually have a DA who is more than willing to, you know, go after anybody that's wrong in this case. So if, you know, if this were reversed, I would imagine he'd be going after murder in the first degree. If David Jones had done this to Powell now, right? So, you know, they're having an interaction, the Powell now starts running away and David Jones shoots him in the back. I'm sure Larry Krasner would have no issue, you know, charging David Jones up with murder one. But what you have here that is different is a DA who is actually willing to do this and put resources behind it and actually try it. I think that this, my bigger question, Denise, is I think one of strategy, and that is murder one the right charge? Because there was a gun that was found. Now, look, I'm you know, as far as conspiracy theories go, I am not above thinking that a gun can be planted on a person in a police shooting. And there's a lot of evidence to back that up, that it happens in departments all around the country. But a jury is not going to be able to consider that. They would just know that David Jones was found with a gun. Was it his or not? That's not going to be the issue. So I think that will still, will that be enough to put reasonable doubt to say, well, even though he was running, he might turn and fire. And he's not, so it can't be murder one versus a lesser charge of manslaughter. Though that's not what, you know, many of us would want. I think the question is, do you go after what the charge you want that can't be proven, or the lesser charge you don't want that would actually get him convicted?
Well, that's,
I don't know, what do you think?
Well, that's the critique that Marilyn Mosby went through in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore. It was
right.
said that she charged too high. And, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you got to take the bird in the hand when the two in the bush isn't available, because the people who want you to take these kind of cases to trial, all they want is justice. They want some form of justice. And while they may think that you have a murder one case, if you point out to them that the evidence isn't there, they're usually very reasonable about that. Because what they want is for somebody to be accountable for the death of their loved one.
That's just my concern in this. When I saw Murder One, that's my concern. And it's, you know, if you take gun out of it, if you take David Jones had no weapon and no weapon was ever found, then I think at that point it's a slam dunk. But he is going to testify that when I frisked him, and they're going to say, well, you know, stopping and frisk, you stopped him and frisked him, there was no probable cause to frisk him. Yeah, all of that may be true, but I felt a gun, and it was confirmed after I shot and killed him that he had a gun. And I feared for my life that even though he was 25 feet away, running in the other direction as fast as he could, I feared that he would turn and shoot me. Now, it's not what you and I think, you know, is reasonable, because we're not going to be on the jury.
Nope.
This jury is going to probably largely be made up of white people in Philadelphia. And they will, and, you know, his attorneys will find all kind of ways to strike black people off of this jury. And so, again, I think the question that many of us have to ask is, can this be proven? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but you know who is? Who can answer this?
Larry Krasner.
And he's the district attorney. He's on the line right now. Mr. District Attorney, welcome back to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Well, thank you for having me, Reverend and Ms. Clay. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm just over here, you know, doing your job right now. You know, preachers, we believe we know everything. So talk about this. Listen, it was a historic moment yesterday. Bringing an indictment against a police officer in this type of case, know politically that it's obviously risky and, not an easy decision to come to. Can you talk about, before we kind of get into the appropriate nature of the charge, can you just kind of fill us in on the grand jury process? How long did they have? When did this? I mean, it seems like this came, but you're like Robert Mueller. Nobody knew anything, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, there was already a grand jury. Just give us kind of a timeline if you can.
You know, there are limits to what I am permitted to say because there are grand jury secrecy laws that protect the process, what happens in the process, who the grand jurors are, how they're voted,
sure.
all those sorts of things. But what I can tell you is that grand juries sit for lengthy periods of time. They often hear multiple cases at one time. They will sit occasionally, meaning they won't sit every single day of the week, and they will take a little bit of evidence on case one, a little bit of evidence on case two, a little bit of evidence on case five one day, and then somewhere down the road, they'll take evidence on cases 4, 3, and 1. And this goes on for an extended period of time as, you know, whatever is presented to them before they will make a finding. What happened in this case is that the grand jury made a presentment, which is a recommendation of charges to the DA's office, and they agreed upon certain facts. They found certain facts when they made that recommendation. What those facts indicate is that you have a man who is running and is unarmed, and he is shot at and killed through the back as he is running farther and farther away from Officer Panoff, who is shooting him. It is a case that is, is in fact more difficult, speaking as a trial attorney, than if there had been no gun at all. But the finding of the grand jury, and I can tell you separate and apart from the grand jury, that the district attorney's office looked at all the documentation, all the forensics and so on, and also viewed the video that exists of part of this incident in the case. The finding of the grand jury is consistent with the information that the district attorney's office had separate and apart from the grand jury. And that finding is that it is very, very clear that at the time when the shots were fired, that there was no gun on Mr. Jones, that the gun had been thrown about 25 feet away from where the confrontation was occurring between Mr. Jones and Officer Pownall. And so we are clear. Those 25 feet are not in the direction that Mr. Jones ran away. They are in the opposite direction. We're talking about Mr. Jones' gun being 25 feet behind the officer as the officer has turned and is firing in the opposite direction at Mr. Jones. And what makes it even stronger, frankly, is that the grand jury has found that Officer Pownall told his fellow officer words to the effect of, "The gun was thrown," immediately after Officer Pownall had killed Mr. Jones. So, again, I don't try cases in the press. We try cases in the court, and we have been more careful about that than our predecessors and continue to do that. But I also tried a lot of cases, including a lot of homicides. And any defense is possible. I'm not going to speculate on what it might be. But if the contention is going to be, "I knew it was thrown, but I didn't know it was thrown," that becomes problematic. And just so we are all clear as well, the United States Supreme Court has not said that you can shoot someone because that person is a fleeing felon. In fact, in a rather famous case of Tennessee versus Garner quite some time ago, the U.S. Supreme Court was very clear that when you kill someone or you shoot someone, that is a Fourth Amendment seizure, meaning that you have done something that impacts an individual's civil rights. And under that law, the amount of force you use has to be proportional to the danger. Well, if the danger is that an unarmed man is running away from you, then someone's going to have to explain to me how it's reasonable to keep shooting at him until he's dead. All right? I take no delight in having to charge a police officer. The fact is that my office has considered a total of 19 cases in which there were weapons discharges by on-duty police officers, and we have charged one person at this time, one police officer. 10 of those cases were shootings of dogs. 2 of those cases were accidental discharges. 7 of those cases were shootings, either non-fatal or fatal, of civilians by police. 3 of them were fatal, and we looked at that evidence very carefully, and sometimes we saw absolutely nothing wrong with what the officers did. Sometimes we thought that there were mistakes made or there were training issues, but it did not rise to the level of a crime. In this instance, a grand jury A grand jury did its job. And when they did their job, they determined that they felt it was appropriate for there to be charges of homicide generally, which means first degree and it means third degree, and it means voluntary manslaughter, right? It doesn't just mean the one charge. It means all 3 of those charges. And they recommended to the district attorney's office those charges. At this time, we have brought all of those charges. And, as with every case we handle, we're going to try to be just as fair to Officer Pownall as we are to the family of Mr. Jones. We're going to be, try to treat this even-handedly in the same way that we're trying to deal with Michael White case and the killing of Mr. We're trying to be as even-handed as we can here, and we are open to getting more information from all sources, including the defense. We have offered in a number of cases so far, and we are offering again, that if the defendant would like to come in and would like to speak to us and explain to us the defense that we would hear in the middle of a trial, then we will hear that information, consider it, and see whether it affects our charging. But, you know, I have to tell you, and I know I'm talking on and on here, I have to tell you that this is fair. We thought about it long and hard. This grand jury did diligent work on it. This is, at this point, the proper selection for charges to bring based upon all the information that we have. And it only feels funny because it has been so long in Philadelphia and a prosecutor was interested in holding police to an equal standard with other people. But we are. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Now, it's funny that you brought up the case from 20 years ago, because after the press conference, I went and did some research to get a little more information with the help of my friend and colleague, Vincent Thompson, to get some information on the last case that of a police officer that was tried, the Christopher D. Pasquale case. And that case ended with not one but two judges throwing the case out. It never went to trial. Are you concerned that's going to happen here? That there will be no judge that's willing to hear this?
You know, my belief is that there are a lot of courageous judges out there. I happen to be married to one. But, you know, judges are like anybody else. They're like prosecutors. Some prosecutors are all about the politics, and I think we've all seen enough of that. And other prosecutors are not. By the way, very interesting news out of Boston, with the primary victory of a very, very progressive candidate for DA up there. This progressive thing seems to be going city to city with DAs. So, you know, there's always the possibility. Humans are frail. They are not perfect, that we could end up with a judge who is not interested in being fair and following the law. But that is not my assumption. My assumption is that these judges are going to do the right thing, that a jury is going to give us a fair verdict. I have to say this, I am a big fan of Philadelphia juries, and my experience with having tried a whole lot of them is that, generally speaking, they are diverse. Most of the juries that I've dealt with have had a pretty proportionate and appropriate distribution of people of color and white people, of men and women on them. And the other thing about Philly juries is that I believe that they understand the reality of urban policing almost better than any other juries I've seen in the counties, or God knows in the federal court, which is basically a Donald Trump jury. You know, what their reality is that a lot of those jurors are related to a police officer. They're also close in some way or another to someone who's done hard time. And many of them also know someone who's been a victim of a terrible crime. So, you know, they're not people who come in taking sides. There are people who come in understanding all different dimensions of this, and that's exactly the kind of jury that I would like to see consider this case, because I think they'll be fair.
Hey, DA, real quick, because we're running up on the break and you got to roll. Do you what can happen in this hearing in a couple of weeks? Is it possible that the judge would say, okay, it can go forward, but I'm not going to let it go forward for first degree? It has to come down. Is that possible?
Well, you know, without getting into it too much, I should tell you that, you know, when a grand jury makes a decision like this, it is possible to make a motion that you not have a preliminary hearing, because in reality, probable cause has already been established by the recommendation and the findings made by a grand jury. So question one is, will there be a preliminary hearing, or will this thing go directly towards a trial date? We will find out the answer to that question. If it goes directly towards a trial date, then there will not be a preliminary hearing where that particular development is a possibility. Someone would have to try to do something at the trial phase. If there is a preliminary hearing, then we will present the evidence. And if we feel that the judge has done something inappropriate, we have the opportunity to appeal that as well. But I'm not starting out assuming any of that. You know, we have ultimately a situation that is a little bit like a handcuff case. And what I mean by that is, someone may have done a lot of bad things, fought with a police officer, something of that sort. But the minute the cuffs are on, everybody understands you can't beat him up anymore. Mm-hmm. That's the end of it. You know, he may do time, maybe a lot of time for what he did before the cuffs went on. But you cannot shoot him, hit him, beat him after the cuffs are on. Well, once that gun is off, Mr. Jones, and he is running for his life and running away, you can't keep shooting at him. It's not that complicated. I think we all get that. You know, you are shooting an unarmed person. So I am confident that we are going to have a good judge make a proper decision, and if there's any disappointment in that for any reason and we feel that it's inappropriate, then we have the option of appeal.
All right. All right. Well, listen, District Attorney Larry Krasner, thank you for being kind enough to come in this morning to let us hear directly from you. And listen, I know it's a lot of heat on both sides, but, you know, thanks for doing what you're doing, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Well, you know, the good news is I don't want to be a politician, so it's working out well. All right. Well, thank you both.
Thanks for calling in.
All right. District Attorney Larry Krasner. We'll be right back on the other side of the break. We'll speak to Elder Melanie DeBose of Power to get her thoughts on this as it relates to the Power Live Free campaign. And, yes, Ayanna Pressley, the latest example that, you know, Democrats who are trying to ride this middle-of-the-road thing better watch their backs. We'll be right back.
WWDB Philadelphia, 860 AM.
You're listening to Mark and Denise in the Morning on 860 AM WWDB, a part of Beasley Media. Mark and Denise in the Morning is a product of Tyler Made Media, LLC.
People need justice. What's wrong, Denise, with having accountability on both sides? What's wrong?
Well, nothing. In fact, if the state or the country gives you a right to carry a gun and legally shoot at people, of course you should be accountable when you do that, because that's not a right all of us have. Everybody does not have the right to shoot people and possibly get away with it. You know, no one's got that, you know, not everyone has that right. So because you have that right, you've got to be really responsible for it, and you got to use it judiciously. You can't just get up in the morning and say, you know something, the first suspect that runs away from me is getting popped. Because then that puts you on the wrong end of a murder charge. Or at least it should. And
yeah,
the fact that it did this time, but what I always say when an indictment like this comes down is, okay, we got the indictment. That's nice. Let's see what happens when this goes to trial. And if it goes to trial and there is a conviction, I'm like, okay, that's nice. Let's see what happens with sentencing. And sentencing is usually where the rubber meets the road in these cases, because there's a former police officer in Texas that is doing 15 years in jail for shooting a kid. I mean, he is getting as much time as this kid had years alive. And what he did clearly rose to the level of life imprisonment. And you know, you also got to find a jury that is willing to overlook the fact that the person on trial is a police officer. And I don't think a lot of juries do that. And I think that that's a big part of why a lot of this stuff goes on, because you have there are certain levels of I guess importance that we put certain people on when it comes to when it comes to America. Like, if you're in the military or a first responder, you know, someone whose public service is fairly obvious and involves going into things like burning buildings and hostage situations, you're kind of at the top of the list. You're on the top of the food chain, at least from a perceived respect level. I don't know about actual respect, having been a military brat and seeing how we treat our veterans, I would doubt that. But, you know, but there is a perception of a certain amount of respect because of your station. When you're, but on the, you know, by contrast, if you're a reporter, people can threaten to blow up your newsroom, call you an enemy of the state, and do all this other crap, and you're not even supposed to say anything.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see in Philadelphia, a place that still worships a fictional character, you know, a fictional character that, quite frankly, if I never hear the word Rocky again without the word road after it, I will be fine. But, you know, this is a place that, you know, worships at the shrine of a fictional character and whose favorite food is a meat sandwich that is basically the equivalent of heart attack on a plate. So, you know, this is the group of people that you are asking to find a police officer guilty of murder. And it'll be interesting to see if we can find.
It's going
to
be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if we can find people who are willing to at least consider this.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. So that is going to be the challenge. I mean, so, you know, first step is, you know, put people in office that are actually going to carry out the things that are important to you. We were having this conversation yesterday with some folk, and they were asking us about, you know, Philadelphia and, well, how did you guys elect such a progressive DA? You know, and I said, well, I think a part of it is that, you know, we have, I mean, when I say we, a large group of we, you know, large coalition of people really changed the narrative about the type of DA we wanted. It was not about, let's go get Larry Krasner. It's about, this is the kind of DA we want. And so when other people came forward as candidates and were not speaking the kind of language that was important to the majority of people, and by majority, it's clear because Larry Krasner on paper should not have won, but he blew them away. It wasn't even close. But it was about changing the narrative about, you know, that we actually want a DA that will hold everyone accountable, one that will not turn their back. I mean, people are tired of district attorneys across the country, you know, allowing law enforcement to get away literally with murder. And nobody's saying be more harsh on them than you would be on anyone else. No, be as harsh on them as you would and as you are on everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his election became possible because he came forward embodying and speaking the language that people in this moment wanted to hear. And that's what a lot of the people who got vanquished in that primary didn't understand. They wanted to be the next Lynn Abraham, you know, and, you know, that, you know, I'm tough on crime, all of that. Look, fine. But, you know, cops also commit crimes, too. So don't stop with us. Anyway, listen, this hour is brought to you by Power. Philadelphians organized to witness, empower, and rebuild. Power is the region's leading faith-based organizing effort involved in the fight for fair, adequate education funding, a 21st century wage that you can live off of if you work. I love the sign, Denise, on Monday, my favorite sign out there, mm-hmm. At the Labor Day March with the unions.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. It was a huge sign that said one job should be enough.
It should. I mean,
if that does not capture this spirit.
Hello?
How many jobs you got? How many jobs you got?
Well, I've got this job. I've got my editing and writing job at The Sun. I have my job at the Public Record. And I have several jobs that I end up picking up from time to time, in addition to being a Lyft driver.
One job should be enough.
And I mean, I would appreciate it if it could be.
Yeah, but power is down with that. So fighting for a 21st century livable wage, climate justice, and most importantly for this conversation today, reform and transparency in the criminal justice system through our Live Free campaign. This morning we have on the line, back to Mark and Denise in the Mornings, one of the co-chairs of said Live Free campaign for power, Elder Melanie DeBose, leader of Evangel Chapel in North Philly. Elder DeBose, good morning. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mark and Denise. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Doing all right.
Yeah.
Hey, how are you feeling in this moment? You're what?
I'm spending my last day in Texas. This is the last day of my vacay. And so you're going to be charged up for this one. We're going to do a reverse GoFundMe, but it's okay.
So Denise, I think I just talked myself into a lunch today with this call.
Hey,
absolutely. But all is well. Yes. I've been listening and I've been paying attention to the reports coming out of Philadelphia. And one, I want to remind your listeners that Power, the Live Free platform, is all about, it's a two-pronged platform, and it's all about really addressing issues of mass incarceration and issues of basically policing the police. And really encouraging police to police themselves in a way that they have not down through the years. So as you have just mentioned, we were very interested in a district attorney that would, yes, change the narrative, but really address the issues that are so prevalent in the city of Philadelphia and so such a major concern to Power and its allies. So his first initiative to really reduce the number of black and brown bodies in incarcerated spaces, that has been a very commendable thing. And then to take this very brazen and bold career-altering step to charge this officer for what in everybody's eyes looks like first-degree murder. To take this step, which is very bold and could potentially be career-altering, we commend him for that, and we want to encourage all of the listeners to stand behind our DA. We have had enough opportunities to see justice not carried out, and we have known too well what the narrative looks like and sounds like when officers or men and women in blue have executed miscarriages of justice. We have referred to officers forever. We have made them synonymous with the law. And sometimes we have said to our children and to our neighbors, if you don't do this or that, we're going to call the law. And the reality is they are really there to carry out the law. But time has evolved in such a way that they think themselves not just the law, but above the law. So this gesture on the part of D.A. Krasner and the grand jury hopefully will send a resounding message that, no, you are not above the law. You are to carry out the law, and the law does not give you permission to take the cowardice approach of shooting a fleeing suspect, if you will, in the back. And so I have thought for many, many moments about the Wild Wild West, how it was just a plain, they called them yeller, and they put them on hootskow when you shot a man in the back. And certainly you couldn't shoot a woman, as has been happening in our society today. So I applaud D.A. Krasner for this bold and brazen move. And as has been mentioned, this is a wonderful first step. But I believe that we, Power, and all of its allies will need to stand with this D.A. to support this effort I was not shocked, but certainly appalled by the tone and the intonation and the indignation of the president of the FOP, who bravely stated that this individual was defending himself. And I've never known one to have to defend themselves against someone that was fleeing away in the other direction. And so his posture is typical, and I don't know what power and its allies needs to do to have his feathers ruffled and his seat removed. I know that he is selected within the body, but there may be a need. We've been up to the FOP and we've protested there, but there may be a need to bring more pressure to bear, because I believe, as D.A. Krasner has stated, there should be a nonpartisanship in these seats. And clearly this is not nonpartisan. This is not without bias. This is not without prejudice. We are seeing a microcosm in our city of Philadelphia. We're seeing a microcosm of what we're seeing in the state. Our president has the notion that this is his America, and I believe sometimes that the president of the FOP believes that it's his Philadelphia. And so we are needing to send a message there as well.
Wow. We're speaking to Elder Melanie DeBose, who is the pastor of Evangel Chapel in North Philly and also the co-chair of Powers Live Free campaign that is interested in reforming the criminal justice system, among other things. Getting her thoughts about the indictment on former Philadelphia officer Ryan Pownall, who is now in jail. And, you know, it's interesting. So Krasner didn't say this on the line, but I guess you just kind of put two and two together. If this goes directly to trial and there is no reason to downgrade it, then that means Pownall is going to be in jail for some time until this goes to trial and the trial is concluded, even if he's ultimately exonerated.
Yeah, and based on the news, the press cut release that I heard yesterday, they're putting all of their muscle behind this man, and it's difficult in my mind to put so much energy behind a person who has committed first degree murder. I guess I'm supposed to say allegedly.
Yeah, because.
But who has allegedly committed first degree murder, to put so much energy and muscle behind them, for those of us in black and brown skin, it just reinforces what we believe, they believe, that our lives do not matter. And so I hope that as this process continues, that a resounding message is sent that, yes, this life did matter and does matter. And for the sake of the family, we're hoping that not only does this, it hits all of its hurdles. And the first hurdle has been hit. He has come out. The grand jury has established that this is a case to be tried. And we're hoping that every next step, the hurdles are cleared, so that, as Denise has mentioned, this doesn't get caught up with judges who don't have the strength of their convictions, don't have the courage of their convictions to call this to trial. I'm hoping that everything goes as it needs to go, and that the narrative is ultimately different, because too often the narrative is that there's an indictment or there's an accusation, and then some time elapses, and then before we know it, this person is getting off scot-free. with a promotion and with all kinds of things. We're happy that he has lost his position, but I'm sure he hasn't lost his pension. And so we're hoping that he is prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Wow. So
all right. Well, Elder,
I guess my question for you, and I guess we'll wrap this up with this. Are you optimistic that the case will ultimately be heard? The last time a police officer was charged with murder here in the city of Philadelphia, the case was thrown out of court by not one but two judges. Do you think that there will be a judge brave enough to hear this?
Well, I was thinking about that question as I was listening to you all earlier, and I thought, my position is very, very cautiously optimistic. I hear what you have said about the two judges, and then I heard what D.A. Krasner said about his confidence in the judicial system there. So I'm staying on the cautiously optimistic side, because I have seen too many miscarriages of justice, not only in Philadelphia, but across the nation. And so we hope that it'll go forward. And if it goes forward, and when it goes forward, it will send a resounding message to the FOP and to others that this is no longer a joke. The right man is in the seat, and the right people are standing with him to make sure that we don't have officers with bloodstained hands who continue to posture themselves as not just the law, but above the law.
Wow.
All right. There you've heard it. That is Elder Melanie DeBose, co-chair for the Live Free Campaign for Power, with her thoughts on the indictment. Thank you, Elder.
You're welcome.
And I owe you.
I do. Y'all have a great day. And
you
thank
do
you
the
for
same.
All that you do. All right.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
When you get a friend to call in on vacation, Denise, they're going to make you pay. You do know this, right?
Well, you know, just go somewhere nice for lunch. I mean, I got a couple of recommendations. Yes. Just check me, you know, let me know.
Yeah, I could have waited a day for that call. You know, she's off vacation. She's back tomorrow, she said. So, but we wanted to get her thoughts on this was historic yesterday in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
It's not every day that a police officer is charged with wrongdoing by the DA, let alone murder in the first degree, which I think was the appropriate charge in the shooting death of David Brown. Listen, we've been covering this really for the last year. On this show, on the two previous shows that we're involved in at Word. And so this is something that we've continued to lift up even now here at WWDB. So we're going to continue to follow this. But, hey, listen, Powell is in jail now. Officer Powell is not getting out unless those charges get downgraded. So it sounds like, after hearing the district attorney earlier, that Denise, he will probably spend, these trials don't, they don't move fast in Philly, so he'll probably spend a good 6 months to a year in jail, no matter what, at this point.
Yeah, I'm guessing that we're not going to see a court date for a minute.
Yeah. Well, listen, let's keep this conversation going. District Attorney Krasner actually pointed out that there's like shocking historical news in the Boston area last night as Ayanna Pressley defeated long-term incumbent Mike Capone. And listen, I'm telling you, man, I keep telling folk that not listening. Things are happening inside the Democratic Party, and folk who think this is business as usual are in the wrong season. And so right now, using good AME connections, Denise, while we were interviewing people, I sent a text to the pastor of St. Paul AME Church in Cambridge, Reverend Ellis Washington, who used to be president of Black clergy here in Philadelphia. And he connected us with someone who was involved in the campaign. Monika Bowman is now on the line. Monika, good morning and welcome to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, and it's a joy to be here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So what role did you play in this campaign?
Well, I was a very early supporter of Ayanna Pressley. I'm an elected official here in the city of Cambridge. I serve on the Cambridge School Committee. In addition to being an ordained clergy person in the AME Church, that is the connection with St. Paul AME Church. And from the beginning, I knew that what Ayanna was doing was special and that this district had the capacity to deliver her to Congress, and I'm so proud that we were able to achieve that last night.
Wow. So basically at this point, she's pretty much elected, right? Is there another contender in the general election?
No, there is not a Republican challenger. So it really was a primary competition. And what's significant about that is, you know, I was listening in, you know, for the introduction, and, you know, people had a sense of just because, you know, the opponent, the person that's been in office for 20 years, that establishment was going to be something that was challenging to take down. But what we discovered here on the ground was a very grassroots coalition of people like myself, elected to school boards, elected to city councilors, aldermen, grassroots activists. All of those people came together and created a movement here in the Boston metropolitan area. And that was enough to create change. And I really think that the Democratic Party as a whole needs to pay attention to what is happening. The status quo is not what people want. People are yearning for something more authentic, something that's going to really push for meaningful change that's going to benefit regular everyday people. And I'm just elated and proud to have Ayanna Pressley representing us and to have been a part of making history in the greater Boston area.
Well, talk a little bit about the campaign itself, because what I've observed with some of these races is you have a lot of these incumbents who don't even bother coming back to the district to campaign. Was that the case here? Was this a contentious primary? And really, how far apart was Ms. Pressley from the incumbent?
Well, you know, there was, you know, from my perspective, you know, much respect to Mike Capuano. He has served the district very well. And also, I think that there was a gap as it relates to being able to understand that, you know, the district is shifting. I moved to this region from Atlanta 12 years ago, and I've seen the change over time. And I think sometimes people take for granted that the people that elected you, you know, 20 years ago are the same people that is in your district now. And that simply wasn't the case. And what was really brilliant about Ayanna Pressley and her campaign was that they knew that they needed to be connected to people that were at the grassroots. This is a Tip O'Neill district, and Tip O'Neill said that all politics are local, and she got that. And so she connected in with people that could talk to their neighbors, to engage their church members, to engage ethnic communities that are often left on the sideline when you think about, you know, progressive politics or mainstream politics within the Democratic Party. And she was able to build a dynamic coalition that was able to deliver her a victory.
And let's talk for a minute about progressives and people of color, because what I have found, and this is one of those things that tends to get me into long Twitter arguments with people, is the fact that, at least from what I've seen, the only progressives that seem to care about marginalized communities, like, for example, people of color, are progressives that come from those communities themselves. Like, for a progressive to actually care about the issues of black people, it is generally a black progressive. Is that what you've seen, you know, or is that what you've seen in your area? And is that kind of what helped propel Ms. Pressley, the fact that she is a progressive, you know, that, you know, is actually going to take the issues of communities of color seriously because she is a person of color?
I think that people, you know, there's people that are progressive or Democrat, definitely have a value proposition for the challenges that minority communities or communities of color face. However, I think that there's a fundamental difference for appreciating and having empathy for those type of experiences and having the lived experience of being a person of color and understanding firsthand the implications of, you know, systematic discrimination, how oppression has, you know, influenced, you know, decades, generations of individuals trying to make it in this country, to understand the challenges that's happening with young people when it comes to accessing quality education. Like, it's a difference to be able to have empathy for that versus someone that had the lived experience. And so I think that people have a value proposition for people that are authentic. People want to be represented by people that understand victory as well as struggle. And that is what Ayanna Pressley represented, and it resonated with the people, and so we delivered her to Congress.
Now, I guess, was she in politics before she ran for this office? Did she already have an office? Because I know about her, but I don't know everything about her.
Yes, so Ayanna Pressley was the first African-American woman to be elected to the Boston City Council. She served multiple terms. One of her key victories while she was on the council was really looking at liquor licensing in the city of Boston and really reforming that whole system, because it was a golden ticket. You know, whoever had that liquor license, you know, they were able to hold on to that and then sell that at a remarkable rate. And so she understood that economic vitality and economic development really was connected to people's ability to be able to open businesses in their communities. And so she challenged really the status quo, particularly with being able to access liquor licenses, in addition to being a significant advocate for women and girls. And so that resonated with people. And the truth was, people knew her in Boston, but it took a little work, you know, in other parts of the district where I'm at, in Cambridge, in Milton, in Chelsea, in Somerville, where Mike Capuano was from, for them to really hear and understand her. But once you hear her speak, and once you understand and feel her passion and be in her presence, you're sold. And that is what led us to victory here, because people were able to connect in with an authentic voice, a woman that was connected to issues that deeply impacted communities of color. And more importantly, she knew how to implement change into work systems in order to create more equity for diverse communities within the city of Boston. And now she will do that throughout the whole district.
So let me ask this question. Boston, you know, Pennsylvania and Massachusetts drive me crazy, because when I look at the South, you know, when I look at even the middle of the country, and you look at the congressional delegation makeup, I mean, to say that Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi have more black representation in their congressional delegation than a Massachusetts and a Pennsylvania is really saying something for these states that kind of pride themselves. You know, they kind of look at, oh, race isn't an issue here. That's a Southern thing. And yet somehow the South seems to have it better. In Pennsylvania, we have one black representative, and we've only had one at a time, because apparently we can't ever have more than one. And I'm looking, she will be the first, I don't know the last time you all had someone, but she will become the only black representative in the congressional delegation. Has there ever been talk within Democratic circles about just how wrong that is and the lack of inclusion?
Well, I think that there are people within the Democratic establishment that understand that. But from my experience, you know, in politics in Massachusetts, so a little bit about the city of Cambridge, you know, it's a predominantly white city, and I'm an African-American woman that is serving in a citywide capacity. And I think that as it relates to being in conversation with the Democratic Party, I love the campaign slogan of Ayanna Pressley. It's change can't wait. And so in order to challenge these systems, the Democratic Party, these institutions that pride themselves, or these states or communities that pride themselves on, you know, being progressive, I think it all comes down to people taking the risk of running and understanding what it takes to build a diverse coalition to get you over the finish line. No one is going to, particularly if you're a black woman, no one's going to like tap you on your shoulders and say, hey, you should run for this office. When Ayanna announced that she was running initially, there was huge pushback saying, you know, it's not time. You know, we're going to lose seniority if Mike Capuano leaves. But the reality is that within the Democratic Party, there's one narrative. But then there's something different happening at the grassroots level. And if a candidate of color understands that, know how to build a diverse coalition to push them over the finish line, there's no doubt that people of color can be successful in these districts that has historically not sent people of color to leadership positions. And I fundamentally believe that, and Ayanna believed that, and that's why we have a victory with her. And so now it's how do we tell people that traditionally are not told to run for office, people that don't think that it should be them, how do we position them to be able to take a risk and know that there are going to be key leaders and key people and diverse individuals that's going to help them cross the finish line? Because that's what it's going to take to get more diverse representation at every level of government, particularly at high-profile offices in progressive districts that predominantly do not elect people of color.
All right. Well, Monika, thank you for calling in at, you know, literally at the last minute.
Yes,
we appreciate it. And did I hear you correctly? Because I have a delay. I'm out in the field. Did you say you're an ordained elder in the AME Church?
I am. I was ordained in the 11th Episcopal District and now live here in the Boston area, here in Cambridge, and with Reverend Washington and St. Paul AME Church.
All right. Well, Reverend Monika Bowman, elected official as well in Cambridge, thank you for your work on Ayanna Pressley's campaign and for your own work as well. Sounds like just hearing you that there's probably some things that you'll be doing in the future as well. I kind of hear it in your voice.
Wherever God leads me, I will follow.
There you go. All right. Have a great day. Enjoy the celebration and
yes,
the victory.
Thank you.
You as well. Thanks for having me.
All right. Wow, Denise. I tell you, you know, Denise, I have been saying this is so, and I think so. She's right on the one hand that, you know, people just need to present themselves as candidates and get out there and build a coalition. At the same time, you have to like build up your bench, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Dems, this is the big problem with the Dems. And this is what goes back to my longstanding argument that if they take the House back, that they need to shake up their leadership. That leadership team has to be, you know, be shaken up. Is that they're not trying to find these new voices. And so then all of a sudden when you get to something like the big thing, right? The 2016 general election, you think you can come flip a switch. It's like you bring a bunch of people that don't look like the people you want to vote. And it's like, well, I mean, look, Dwight Evans can only be in so many places in Pennsylvania. You probably need, you know, some black representation from Pittsburgh, someone else from the Philadelphia area, maybe somebody in the middle of the state. You got to diversify what you look like. If you say that you're the party for everyone, that you're going to be the counter narrative to the Republican Party, which seems to be doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on the party for disgruntled white people, then how do you look different when your party is no better when it comes down to those most important seats?
Well, first of all, the party for disgruntled white people sounds like a really good slogan that, you know, kind of fits the Republican Party right now. So I'll just leave that there. As for diversifying the slate, I'm totally in agreement with that. But Democrats have a tendency to, and we're seeing it, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm glad to see that people are realizing that these seats aren't yours, that they belong to the people, and the people can, you know, the people brought you in this seat, they'll take you out. But there's also this cannibalism that's going on. Because while it's nice to have new faces with new ideas and new voices, and that's important and we need that, you also need institutional knowledge. And what I'm really starting to get tired of is the disregard for institutional knowledge. You know, and 'cause you can't, if you disregard institutional knowledge, it goes away. And once it goes away, you don't know what you're doing. And the next thing you know, you're bumping into the podiums.
Right. And so this is my point about developing the bench, right? Mm-hmm. So that you bring people up. So, you know, like Monika, we just spoke to, sounds mm-hmm. like a person that if you're smart and you're the Democratic Party, you're saying, wow, that was great.
You're encouraging her to stay active. And you're right. And I've been saying, again, this is another one of those things I get in arguments on Twitter about. You need to have a bench. It needs to be deep. We don't necessarily need to talk about who's running for president in 2020, but somebody needs to have a list of names, and some of those names need to be people of color, younger people. I mean, I want to see Julian Castro on the list, and not for VP.
Yeah.
I want to see him on the president list. I want to see Kamala Harris on the president list. If you try to trot out some 80 or, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I love Joe Biden. I love him to death. He is fun to cover. He's hilarious. And he's local. But no. All of those people who are trying to get Joe Biden to run, I'm going to need you to stop it now. Because while in 2016, that would have been a good conversation to have, and, you know, I really wish that the forces of the universe could have worked themselves out to where he would have run, because, you know, I think the minute that Joe Biden enters the Democratic primary, it's over. I mean, it's a wrap. But that was 2016. In 2020, I don't see it. And while we're at it, Bernie Sanders, you get up out the paint too. 'Cause your behind is darn near 90. So you go sit down somewhere too. I don't want to see you on the list. So I want to see some people on the list that, A, recognize that they are running against somebody who really does not care about the rules. You know, I want to see some people who are not going to bring a knife to a gunfight. I want people walking in with their own AK, their own AR-15, and looking at the Republican Party and saying, you want a piece of me? Because that's what you're going to need.
And please understand, she's speaking metaphorically.
Yes, I'm speaking metaphorically. Yes. I don't mean for some knucklehead to walk into a debate with an AR-15. Because the minute you do that, I stopped taking you seriously as a candidate.
Yes.
And seeing as it is my lot in life that I am probably going to be able to cover, I'm probably going to be covering this race. Having a reporter walk up, look at you, and start laughing is not the reaction you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, for them to think that somehow, and I'm talking about the Democratic establishment, that there's not a target on their back, right? By people within the party who are dissatisfied. I mean, I'm telling you, go back to the DA election. Denise, I sat through, so Power, you know, I won't call it an interview, but we met with the majority of the candidates who were running, for DA in the DA. And did we meet? I think we met with the Republicans as well. We tried to. We put an invitation out. And so I was able to sit through a number of them. I didn't make it to all of them, but someone from Power met with all of them, just about. And, what was interesting was just how tone deaf they were and how they were not understanding this moment. And I'm sitting there listening to them and I'm like, you know, dude, you sound like a great candidate for DA if this were 1986. It's not 1986. And I don't know how you don't know in this moment, you know, how important it is for people when we talk about ending cash bail. How I don't know how you don't understand how important it is when we talk about ending mass incarceration. I don't know how you don't get these things. And you're talking to us about things that don't even, they weren't even registering. But it seems to me that was like a microcosm, though, of where the party is right now, how they just don't get. I mean, you know, we have issues maybe with some of the, you know, kind of the hardcore Bernie folk, but the issues they bring are right. You know, so you got to, if you're going to be a Democrat, then go in there and fight like hell to get health care for everybody.
But here is my problem with the Bernie bros, who, contrary to rumor, do actually exist. Here's my problem with that wing of the Democratic Party. And it's a big one. When you call the issues that are directly connected to me identity politics, I'm going to need you to grab some cheap flip-flops and kick rocks. Because basically you are telling me, you're trying to sell me on a myth. And that myth is that all I need is money in my pocket and everything else will work out right. Tell that to have that conversation with Colin Kaepernick, whose money has money, and see what you get.
His money has money.
Right. I mean, when you're signing a contract with Nike and they ain't even letting you play.
Yeah.
You're balling. You are a baller.
But again, of course, you're right. That was just because of money. Race had nothing to do with it. So you're right. So look, and you get no argument with me, no pushback there. But I am saying that still, but those issues, those economic issues and really kind of the mood of where the country is going within the party, the people who are at the top are out of touch. And again, a part of it goes to the fact that when you don't bring young people in, when you don't bring them around you, you're not going to understand it and you will be blindsided. How many more times do we have to see people blindsided? This guy in Boston is just like, he's the new Joe Crowley who didn't see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez coming. It's like, dude, if you just put your ear to the ground for about 5 minutes, you will see that a train is coming and it's going to be a wreck. So anyway, hey, Denise, man, I can't believe we're almost at the end of this show today.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Can you talk a little bit about Bob Woodard's book and it's called Fear, and apparently it's striking fear in the heart of the president.
Well, the thing is, it should strike fear in the heart of Americans, because Bob Woodward, and I'm surprised that future White Houses did not learn from the Nixon administration about giving him unfettered access. Because, Bob Woodard and Carl Bernstein brought down a White House. When you're a reporter and you take out a target that big, you would think that all subsequent White Houses, especially if they are as a hot mess as this one, would try their best to keep you from getting access to people. But they did not. And because of this, Bob Woodward has interviewed everyone from General Kelly to General Mattis to, you know, just about everybody he could get, you know, in contact with. And this is a White House that leaks like a sieve. So, you know, there's a section in the book where Donald Trump, there's a section, you know, yesterday that came up in after the story that the Washington Post did on the book was published, where it's President Trump and Bob Woodward talking about what's in the book, and the president is asking, well, why didn't you interview me? And Woodward had allegedly put in 7 requests, all of which were denied. And one was given to Kellyanne Conway, and she booted it. So, you know, there's this tape going around the internet of Trump, you know, and Woodward having this conversation where he's like, basically channeling Keith Sweat, you know, begging him not to be as harsh as he can in the book. But, you know, from what I've heard about it, this is a White House in such disarray that to keep President Trump from taking us even further down the rabbit hole on a trade perspective, the people who work with him on economics have been known to hide his papers to keep him from signing some of the stuff that he wants to sign into an executive order. Now, when you're doing that with a grown man who is the leader of the free world, you kind of understand why world leaders like Francis Emmanuel Macron and Germany's Angela Merkel are trying to come up with ways for the European Union to act completely independently of America, because right now everybody's afraid. The emperor has no clothes on. He is running around D.C. butterball butt naked, N-E-K-K-I-D. And, you know, people are starting to see it now, and they're like, And if you remember, if you're, you know, a child of the 80s like I was, and you remember the Talking Heads video for Once in a Lifetime, you have an entire nation right now that's saying to itself, my God, what have I done?
Well, you don't have an entire nation saying it.
Well, you that's have most of us. You still have that hardcore 36% of the American public that does not see that the water is rising. And yeah, those are the people that are going to be sitting on the on top of the house when the flood comes. While everybody else has gotten up and evacuated, these are the people that are going to be sitting on the top of the house. And the fact is, right now, the American public should be looking at all of this stuff that's coming out in various reported spaces on this White House and start going to their elected officials and saying, tell me again why you're not willing to impeach this guy or get him up out the paint somehow, especially if you have Republican legislators. Tell me again why you're basically indulging this fool's every whim. Help me out.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell you, it's, listen, I mean, in your, yeah, I don't know. It's disheartening. And, we've got another at least 2 years to go with this. And possibly more, because, as your famous line is, what's your famous bet that you'll always take?
The one bet that you should never make with me is that I bet the American people are going to go into a voting booth and do something you don't expect.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. So it could be longer, but, this is, so the picture painted here, I think the big thing is the picture that's painted is one that's consistent with Omarosa and Michael Wolff, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people have got to say this White House is a mess and this dude is crazy before people start realizing this White House is a mess and this dude is crazy? You may not have given Michael Wolff any credibility. You may not have given Omarosa any credibility. But Bob Woodward? If you're not finding what he says credible, I don't know what to tell you, because like I said, this is a dude who brought down a White House. When you bring down a White House, first of all, that takes work. And second of all, that takes having to find some really top-notch information from unimpeachable sources that you have probably been working on for a very long time. In fact, it was so much stuff, it took two people to do it.
Wow.
You know? And the thing is, when people are talking about Nixon longingly, you have a problem. And I have heard people talking about Nixon longingly because of this administration. And I'm like, then we got a problem.
Well, and Denise, is it true that I saw something yesterday that said that the report now is that Omarosa recorded almost every conversation that she had when she was in the White House?
Well, obviously someone taught her how to cover yourself when you work for problematic people. Because there have been some jobs I've had where I had a tape recorder on me at all times because I didn't know what people were going to try to do to me, and I wanted a record. And I guess The Omarosa figured, you know, I don't know what you fools have planned for me. I'm the only black person, you know, of any kind of prominence. I mean, Ben Carson is black, but he's also, you know, probably walking around bumping into this dining room set that the taxpayers bought him. So, you know, so I'm the only person that you guys see all the time. So I'm going to make sure that you guys don't do anything hinky. And that's probably why she taped everything. Now, granted, you know, she probably shouldn't broadcast this stuff because most of it was probably taped without permission. And I'm not 100% sure about DC's recording laws, but I think that, you know, somebody's got to know, you know, that both people have to know they're being taped for you to be able to broadcast it. But she was just covering herself, and I ain't mad at her for that.
Wow. Well, hey, listen, before we get out of here, maybe this week we'll talk a little bit more about the theatrics and the Kavanaugh hearing that started yesterday. You know, I mean, we go through this, even though, you know, at the end of the day, the Republicans are going to vote to confirm him. But Dems are putting up a pretty good fight. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was Johnny Bobbitt Jr., the homeless man who gave $20, his last $20 to a woman who was so moved by the gesture. She was out of gas that she went and started a GoFundMe campaign for him, raised $400,000, some of which was given to him. But there was some dispute around $200,000 to $300,000 of those dollars that never got to him. A judge last week ordered that the family, she and her boyfriend, fiance, turn the money over to a neutral place within a day. Mm-hmm. And now we're understanding from John Bobbitt Jr.'s attorneys from Coles and O'Connor, who are doing this pro bono, mm-hmm. that they say there's no money left.
Gee.
There ain't no money.
What a surprise. This morning when I was getting ready to come, in here, they're going, apparently I didn't know that this was happening in the courthouse, like literally 10 minutes from my house. Cause I hope that's not the case Dan is on.
Oh, wow. That's right. Yikes.
But, you know, the judge is waiting for them to bring this money, and when they don't have it, the judge is going to remember that they told him that they had it no more than 2 days ago. And one thing you do not do is lie to a judge. You especially don't lie to a judge in Burlington County, New Jersey, because that judge was probably military at one time. You're going in the brig. It's going to get ugly. And the thing is, you got to ask yourself, you knew that money was gone all along. You knew it. You had to know it because that BMW in your parking lot probably says, hey, remember, the money is gone. Or that exotic vacation you went on probably says, hey, remember, the money is gone. But the thing is, you took that money from people who donated it to this homeless veteran who was kind enough to help you out when you were in a jam. And for you to have basically partied with this money, and you keep trying to say that the dude is still using drugs, and yet I have not heard about drug test the first that confirms or denies this. You know, this is just shadiness. And the thing is, I come from a shady part of South Jersey, and, you know, where most of the people are really, really good people, but, you know, We got our shady folk. And obviously these two folks are part of the shady set. And they're about to find out that being shady to a judge and lying to him on top of it, you know, that's going to get you in trouble.
Well, sounds like it.
Especially with a veteran in that part of Jersey, forget it.
Yeah, social media this time is not going to be their friend, trust me. So, hey, listen, that's all we have for today, folks. I want to thank all of our guests for calling in. Thank you for listening. Remember, go to the GoFundMe page. Help keep Mark and Denise in the mornings alive. And listen, we'll be back on tomorrow, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Have a good day, everybody.
Peace.